Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resumption of large-scale demonstrations in Armenia's capital, Yerevan, against Serzh Sargsyan, the long-serving president who, like Putin and Turkey's Erdogan, appointed himself prime minister, but provoked so much outrage he was forced to step down because of people power. Gregor Adanasyan, a political commentator and journalist covering Armenia, who has an op-ed in the Moscow Times, "What Does Turmoil in Armenia Spell for Russia?", joins us to discuss Putin's growing alarm at the possibility of a youth-led colored revolution breaking out in Armenia, with a new round of popular unrest erupting, sparked by the break-off of talks between the opposition and the Deputy Prime Minister Karapetyan, who was appointed by the ousted leader and was a former executive with Russia's Gazprom. We will assess the situation. Then we will examine the proposal by the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Ben Carson, to triple the rents that low-income families will be expected to pay for subsidized housing. At the same time, we are learning that the Fox News host, Sean Hannity, who is so close to the president he has been described as Trump's shadow chief of staff, has received sweetheart loans from HUD that have boosted Hannity's $100 million real estate portfolio. Robert Silverman, a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Buffalo School of Architecture and Planning, joins us to discuss efforts underway to privatize HUD so that instead of providing housing for low-income families, the priority will be to make real estate developers and speculators rich. Then finally, we'll look into the most brazen example of what a cynical lie Trump's promise to drain the swamp was, with Mick Mulvaney, President Trump's head of the OMB and acting head of the CFPB, speaking yesterday before the American Bankers Association, who have donated $32,000 to Mulvaney's political campaigns, making the extraordinarily honest admission of his corruption, telling the bankers that, quote, "If you are a lobbyist who never gave us money, I didn't talk to you. If you are a lobbyist who gave us money, I might talk to you." Lisa Gilbert, a vice president of legislative affairs at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss how Trump and his cabinet are filling the swamp while lining their own pockets. And joining us now is Gregor Adanasyan, who is a political commentator and journalist covering Armenia and a Fulbright scholar at the Missouri School of Journalism, as well as the former editor of Esquire Russia. He has an op-ed at the Moscow Times, "What Does Turmoil in Armenia Spell for Russia?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregor Adanasyan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, where do you think this is heading? It certainly looks like a colored revolution, and it must be giving Vladimir Putin heartburn, although signals from the Kremlin are very calm at this point. But of course, Armenia is so dependent upon Russia economically. There's a huge Russian military base, and you have an ongoing military standoff over the disputed territory between Armenia and Azerbaijan. So where do you think we're heading in this situation where it seems like a youthful protest movement has grown right across full spectrum of Armenian society, and I guess they're sick of these old Soviet crooks and want a fresh start. But will they get it? Will Russia allow this young opposition leader, Pashinyan, to take over?
Thank you, Ian. So you've asked a couple of questions. Let me start with the color revolutions. I will respectfully disagree. I don't think that what is happening in Armenia is a color revolution, because the previous, what we call color revolutions, to say that there was that happened in Georgia, in Ukraine, and others, they had a very, very strong geopolitics angle. They were the goal was to turn the country's geopolitical orientation from Russia and from union with Russia to the West, to union with the US, to possible joining of the European Union and NATO, which is NATO, of course, for Vladimir Putin is the biggest fear. he doesn't like, he doesn't want to have NATO members around his borders, right? So we have seen so far nothing of that in Armenia. The protest leader, Nikol Pashinyan, who you mentioned, he is actually a long-standing critic of Armenia's relations with Russia, and he was very skeptic about Armenia's alliance with Russia, but he never, ever mentioned this during this protest. I think he knows that Putin won't like it, and, you know, the Kremlin won't be happy with hearing that, and he doesn't want Russia to meddle into this process. And so far it was successful, because, as you've told, Russia is not taking sides. The Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, he told that it's exclusively an internal, a domestic affair of Armenia. They are not taking sides so far. So I don't know. We'll see. Today they reiterated their stance. Russia is not taking sides. And Pashinyan, he announced that he met a senior Russian official in Yerevan today. We don't know who was that. He didn't say, and we can't say for sure. But he said that he got sort of confirmation that Russia will not support either part, either side. Because it's now, as you've said, it's him versus the establishment. Because the Armenia's unpopular leader, Serge Sarkisian, he's gone. But there is still a majority Republican Party, which is despised, frankly hated in Armenia. And it still tries to, you know, hold on power and keep its majority in parliament. Actually, the ruling coalition today was sort of dissolved because they are a major partner in the coalition, Armenian Revolutionary Federation. It's called the Revolutionary Federation, but it's a traditional, pretty establishment political party. They left the coalition. So probably in the next few days, we will see the MPs for the ruling majority party flip and, you know, change sides. We will see. It's a standoff. But luckily, there is no Russian meddling so far. And perhaps that's because U.S. and European Union, they are not taking sides either. They haven't supported any of the sides yet. And I think that's how it's going to continue. We'll see.
Well, they'd be really stupid if they did, wouldn't they? The West, well, if they meddled in this situation. That would be unnecessarily provocative. Wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't that be I don't see any signs that would be. But what I was curious about, though, is that when you say the Armenians are disgusted with these crooked, long-serving sort of relics of the Soviet Union capturing their politics and basically not being immovable objects, and there's obviously a big youthful component in this. So if the average Armenian despises the Republican Party, how different is that from a lot of the Russians, particularly the young Russians, despising United Russians? Russia, Putin's party, which has been described as the party of thieves and swindlers.
So it's pretty similar, but it's, see, that's the difference, because in Russia, the liberal elite, the educated urbanites, the population of Moscow and St. Petersburg and other bigger cities, they've been long very anti-Putin, and they were pretty, you know, sympathetic of opposition, but that was never. And I don't know if it ever will soon be a popular sentiment, because the majority still genuinely supports Putin. In Armenia, it's very different, because this movement, it was nothing like Russian anti-Putin protest. It was a huge, egalitarian, massive movement which united Armenians of all classes. You will see, you know, people who, architects and startup entrepreneurs who moved from Los Angeles to Armenia because of the Armenian heritage, and they wanted, you know, to contribute to the homeland, ancestral homeland. And then you will see local working class and bus drivers, you know, and people of all classes together in that. So that's very different from Russia. And that's a sign that Armenia really has a pretty vibrant civil society, which is surprising, because it's basically since 1991, since the dissolution of Soviet Union, it has been an oligarchic state. And you mentioned a couple of times how this, you know, power, people in power, they are the Soviet sort of crooks, as you said. But there is, they are pretty much Soviet in terms of how they rule, but there is also this neoliberal sort of capitalist dimension to that, because they also, you know, their rule brought some terrible, pretty huge inequality to Armenia. So it's more of marriage of the Soviet style authoritarianism and, you know, global neoliberal capitalism. That's how I would say, which redistributes wealth very unfairly.
And again, I'm speaking with Grigor Atanasyan, who is a political commentator and journalist covering Armenia and a Fulbright scholar at the Missouri School of Journalism, as well as the former editor of Esquire Russia. He has an op-ed at the Moscow Times, "What Does Turmoil in Armenia Spell for Russia?" But it's pretty clear that Putin wants the Karapetian to stay in there, doesn't he? I mean, he's the former 53-year-old Gazprom veteran who's with Gazprom, vice president of Gazprom Bank, and CEO of a Gazprom subsidiary. And, of course, he's partnering with his namesake, who was an Armenian-born Russian billionaire. They're not related, of course, but... is this billionaire Karapetian? Is he in the inner circle of Putin? You know, like the Siloviki.
So, Ian, look, we don't know of that, but to some extent, you can't be a billionaire in Russia and be totally independent. Otherwise, you won't be a billionaire. But we don't know of his specifically close ties to Putin. And I would be cautious about saying that Karapetian is Putin's guy. So far, we haven't seen that. Perhaps, you know, from the Kremlin's perspective, so once again, this movement in Armenia, it's a huge mass movement supported in all, you know, strata and circles of society. And perhaps they don't want to side with the political group which is despised by everybody. I don't know. And perhaps they just know that whoever wins, if Nikol Pashinyan, the young energetic Democrat, who is Russia skeptic, if he wins, still there is very little for him to do. He won't be, you know, he won't be changing totally Armenian. There is no way to make a U-turn in Armenian geopolitical stance. Russia and Armenia are allied military, and Russia guarantees Turkey's non-involvement in Armenian conflict with neighboring Azerbaijan. So, and today during a press conference, or last night during a press conference, Pashinyan was asked, is he a pro-Western or pro-Russian candidate? And he said that it's a stupid question, and as Armenian politician, he's only a pro-Armenian candidate. So he tries to navigate this dynamic. And Moscow watches closely. And so far as he doesn't want to change this orientation, I guess, you know, for them it's like, why not? If he is ready to cooperate with Russia and still keep the alliance, I would expect him to. However, I would expect him to sort of try to negotiate the terms of the alliance, because there is a lot of worrisome developments. Part of it is Russia's arms sales to Azerbaijan, which is Armenia's main enemy geopolitically speaking. So. This kind of stuff, he could try to sort of find a better terms for Armenia in its alliance with Russia and develop and diversify Armenia's geopolitical stance, but he won't be breaking away, because there is just no way for Armenia to break away, especially with the U.S. now retreating from the region. The U.S. is less and less present in this region. So there is no way, you know, there is no way... Nobody to look at. Sure. He would love to.
Well, but as long as you have the territorial dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh, and with the Russians, you just mentioned that Moscow sold Baku $5 billion worth of military equipment. At the same time, there's a big Russian military base in Armenia. So what's Russia's position over settling this dispute? I mean, recently there a number of Armenians were killed in a surprise attack. So as long as that's an open wound, you're not going to have the stability that you need, are you?
So, yeah, that's a very good question, Ian, because Russia's role in this conflict, Russia is a part of Minsk Group together with the U.S. It's a group within the OSCE international organization which tries to negotiate a peace agreement of some kind between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It haven't happened so far, and frankly, Russia doesn't want war in Nagorno-Karabakh, but since it fell in arms and weapons to both sides of the conflict, maybe it doesn't necessarily want this conflict to be, you know, to be stopped and the agreement to be found pretty anytime soon because it benefits from the arms sales. So this is a very troubling role of Russia. And I think a new Armenian leader can try to to communicate Armenia's issues with that, because at the end of the day, Russia and Armenia are allied within a military alliance. So Armenia has, you know, formal rights to request from Russia to obey to the terms of this alliance and not to help its main geopolitical enemies. So we will see.
If you're getting a more democratic, more transparent, and more representative government in Armenia, you're not going to get the same in Azerbaijan. It's a kleptocracy run by oligarchs, and some of them, like the Agalerovs, are close to Putin, and of course they're tied in with the whole Trump Russia scandal. I can see why, to some extent, giving arms to both sides gives Russian leverage. And maybe they don't want war over Nagorno-Karabakh, but maybe they don't want peace, as you just pointed out, because that gives them some leverage. So just to finish up, though, on the question, could there ever be peace? Could they ever settle over Nagorno-Karabakh?
I think you have a great point. I doubt with the Aliyev corrupted family ruling in Azerbaijan, we have a chance for peace, because they use this conflict pretty much for the internal propaganda. Because, once again, as you've mentioned, it's a corrupted state. There is no real democracy. It's a dictatorship, an open dictatorship. So, but they use this image of the, you know, external foreign enemy to rally around behind the leader and to unite the nation, whereas there is no other point for the nation to unite with its corrupted elite. If you follow the Panama Paper publications of this amazing work of a group of investigative journalists, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize last year, so the whole chapter of Pulitzer Prize winning Panama Papers was dedicated to the Aliyev family, ruling family of Azerbaijan. So with these people in charge in Azerbaijan, I doubt that we have a good chance of peace. But once again, Russia has a leverage, as you've mentioned. And the question really is, do the Russians want peace, or do they want the same situation of providing the arms for both sides?
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, is there a coincidence here that these demonstrations broke out in Armenia, in its capital, Yerevan, on the anniversary of the Armenian genocide?
Yeah, this is just a coincidence because the unpopular leader Serge Sarkisian, he assumed power in April, early this month. He was the first Armenian leader to try to stay in power longer than, you know, he could have to. So he tried to do that. It didn't work for him. And Armenians just took to the streets and pushed him out of office. So this is just a coincidence, yes.
So just to sum up here, you think that Russia's not going to intervene. This is not a colored revolution. Armenia is so tied economically and geopolitically to Russia, it's unlikely. And you think this young, certainly not pro-Russian, Nikol Pashinyan, will he'll survive all of this? He looks like the new leader, right?
So he's basically now somewhat close to a national hero.
Right.
And he shows himself as a politician who has an amazing talent of reinventing himself because he's been around for long. He's been a leading opposition politician for the last 10 years. He wasn't ever the main one, but he was always among the, you know, top mm-hmm. 10 opposition leaders at least. And he kept reinventing himself, and he learned from his mistakes, and he has a talent for that. I feel like it feels like the momentum is on his. He has a momentum definitely right now. So people support him. There is a decent chance he will end up tonight. Last night in Armenia, the street, the protesters sort of nominated him for PM's office, but he wanted to do it legally. He wanted to take to parliament and to get him elected by the MPs constitutionally, and then overlook an interim government and call a snap election. And at this election, he is a favorite. He is expected to win.
Well, we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us, Grigor Atanasyan.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Grigor Atanasyan, who's a political commentator and journalist covering Armenia and a Fulbright scholar at the Missouri School of Journalism, as well as the former editor of Esquire Russia. He has an op-ed at the Moscow Times, "What Does Turmoil in Armenia Spell for Russia?" We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Dr. Ben Carson, the head of HUD, is tripling the rents of low-income families while giving sweetheart loans to Fox News host Sean Hannity. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Silverman, a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Buffalo School of Architecture and Planning, who studies community development and inequity in urban communities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Silverman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thanks, Robert. And the head of the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, Dr. Ben Carson, on Wednesday, proposed tripling the amount of rent that the poorest households are expected to pay, as well as encouraging those receiving housing subsidies to work. This is a proposal obtained by the Washington Post, and it couldn't happen at a more extraordinarily hypocritical time. If my understanding is that HUD's supposed to be dedicated to low-income housing and helping the poor, in effect. So here we have tripling rents and making people work, at the same time giving sweetheart loans to Sean Hannity to build up his $100 million real estate portfolio. That just strikes me as callous hypocrisy. Is there a connection here? Or is it? I mean, certainly there are coincidences, isn't there?
Well, it's very ironic because at the same time that stories are coming out about some of these kind of sweetheart deals for investors who were kind of making profits after the recession, buying up foreclosed properties and building real estate portfolios, in many cases with assistance from HUD through various types of subsidized mortgages or interest reductions, we see policies coming out now that seem very mean-spirited, really targeting the poorest people who are in the public housing system, and many of them already working and trying to make ends meet on jobs that simply don't pay enough to allow them to you know live in market rate housing, and they're the folks who are kind of being identified as kind of the problem in the system, and the ones who aren't kind of pulling their own weight in ways that, that really aren't representative even of data that HUD collects.
So I would have thought, though, the crisis in this country is about low-income housing. And we certainly here in Los Angeles, you can see on the streets the growing number of homeless and little tent cities sprouting up everywhere. So isn't that HUD's mandate or responsibility to build more low-income housing rather than penalize the people who already have housing? I mean, I just don't understand what you're going to gain out of tripling the rents. And what is the relationship between Hannity and the loans that he's getting? Is that to build low-income housing?
Well, my understanding from news reporting is that Hannity, like a lot of, you know, kind of institutional investors, were buying up properties at the end of the last recession, the 2008 to 2011 period, and kind of building real estate portfolios. And in some cases, there was, you know, HUD assistance in financing some of those property acquisitions. And so it's really ironic because Hannity probably owns some properties where people who are receiving housing assistance are using that federal subsidy to actually pay their rents. And I don't think that he was directly involved in the policy decisions that are coming out of HUD now, but it seems to be against even his own interests in terms of his real estate holdings. In terms of what HUD's proposing, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a lot of kind of window dressing. I don't know if the actual policy proposals that Secretary Carson was talking about on Wednesday will ever be approved by Congress because they need congressional approval. But it seems to be just kind of the narrative that's coming out of the higher levels of HUD that seems to be arguing that there are a large number of people in the affordable housing system who are gaming the system in some way. And that's simply not supported by HUD. And I know there are a lot of people who work line jobs in HUD who are probably not necessarily in agreement with those policy proposals. And in some ways, they're probably kind of baffled by what's coming out of the Secretary's office.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Silverman, who's a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Buffalo School of Architecture and Planning, who studies community development and inequity in urban communities. Well, Hannity, of course, has had Dr. Carson on his television show on Fox, which has, I think, the highest ratings of all of the cable shows, or at least it's up there. And, of course, he did not disclose, while he was praising Ben Carson, he didn't disclose any relationship on the air. And, you know, he's paid $36 million a year, and he's apparently hosted Carson just last June on Fox News for a discussion about HUD and housing, in which Hannity praised these privatization plans, which both President Trump and Dr. Carson are pushing. What exactly are they doing? We know that probably the reason why, apart from the fact that the White House physician has a pretty spotty record, to say the least, his possible tenure as head of the VA and is now pretty shaking. But we know that there's a lot of pressure on him and anybody that becomes the head of the VA to privatize the VA. That's a big effort underway. So knowing that's underway and being pushed by the Koch brothers front group, Concerned Veterans for America, is the same thing happening with HUD? I mean, what would privatization of HUD mean? And obviously Hannity is pushing it, but what would the consequences be?
Well, there's been a very long incremental trend towards, you know, privatizing certain parts of the public housing inventory, you know, dating back, you know, to the, you know, middle of the Obama administration with what they called the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. And that's one of the most rapidly expanding programs, you know, within HUD in terms of, you know, housing. And in essence, what that does is it turns public housing over to the private sector to both rehabilitate and manage that property, and then private management companies will make income based on both the renovation work that they do in public housing units and also on the management of those properties as well. And so that's really been accelerated under the Trump administration. That's one of the things that expanded in the last budget cycle. And that's also shared some pretty widespread support from both Democrats and Republicans. And so that's really kind of a long-term trend. And it's really counterintuitive to even the proposals that just recently came out to do things like, you know, raise the, you know, income limit or the income levels that public housing tenants' rents are based on, and to initiate some of these more punitive work requirements on public housing residents, although, you know, most of those requirements already are well within the parameters of the amount of work that most people in public housing do who, you know, are not disabled or elderly already. And so privatization is something that's been happening already. It probably would have been happening regardless of who was in the administration. But there's, you know, kind of a push to really reduce all other aspects of what HUD does. And you know, so far the pushback from Congress has been to kind of reject those proposals and actually increase HUD spending. And that's what happened in the last budget cycle. But the Trump administration has already made proposals for the next budget cycle that really kind of eliminate some of those kind of sustainable or sustaining kind of revenues that have gone into HUD.
Well, it looks, though, through these shell companies that Sean Hannity is buying up, as you say, after the housing crisis and the collapse in 2008, you had all these sort of vultures coming in and picking up these properties. But as far as I can tell from the reporting coming from The Guardian, that Carson, the head of HUD, has allowed Hannity to have these mortgages replaced with loans that have been rewritten at a new bank, and that Carson has given Hannity the authority to allow him to convert the rental complexes, which I imagine is low-income housing, into condominiums for sale, which would be hugely profitable. So that seems on the surface to sort of go against the mission of HUD. The idea is to have low-income rental units rather than luxury condominiums.
Well, yeah, and I am not familiar with the whole makeup of, you know, the portfolios that Hannity and others have invested in. I'm sure there's segments of them that have conditions applied to them that require units to remain affordable, and there might be some other segments of those portfolios that, you know, are purely market rate. And HUD plays a role in, you know, assisting with financing for all types of properties. You know, they're involved with, you know, the FHA mortgage market, with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and also with, you know, a variety of different programs that have more stringent requirements for subsidized housing. And what it seems to indicate is that the lack of some more detailed critique of HUD policy coming out of people like Hannity, who might have investments like that, might indicate that they're not even familiar with, you know, the kind of makeup and mix of their own kind of investment portfolios, because obviously some of the policies that are coming out of HUD are counterintuitive to making those affordable properties that investors own, you know, sustainable over time. And from a objective standpoint, people in the media should be kind of, you know, critiquing the policies from that perspective if they're consistent with those goals of providing affordable housing that HUD has really kind of had as their core mission since the creation of HUD. But at the same time, the whole issue of just disclosing conflicts of interest, you know, are things that have recently come to the surface with some people in the media who have investments, and I guess Hannity would be an example of that.
Well, apparently Hannity bought 11 properties in Georgia from a fellow called Jeff Brock, who pleaded guilty in 2016 to federal charges of bank fraud and conspiracy for his role in an operation to rig foreclosure auctions between 2007 and 2012. So it does, you know, on the surface just seem so cruel and misplaced, the idea that people should be getting rich off the housing crisis and then converting, you know, low-income properties to condominiums. And I just, again, it goes, it's hard for me to understand how HUD's mission could have moved from taking care of low-income people and providing housing to turning, handed in all these other people into kind of welfare queens. I mean, it's, I guess you could describe it as right-wing welfare. How do you see it?
Well, yeah, and I mean, you brought up the Jeff Brock example, and I think the positive thing about that is that there was some type of, you know, action, you know, from the Justice Department or some other, you know, state-level agency where they actually pressed charges against him, and it ended up resulting in him, you know, pleading guilty, you know, to crimes. And there was a lot of abuse that took place during the foreclosure crisis where investors and others, you know, came and kind of took advantage of a lot of people's hardship that took place during the recession. And hopefully that should be kind of a process that continues to move forward in terms of getting transparency in terms of who these investors are, and also, you know, more aggressive prosecution of people when they commit crimes. And we would hope that the Justice Department would take an aggressive stance towards, you know, that type of fraud that might take place with the government, because it really muddies, you know, the waters, and it also creates a stigma on any investor who's trying to do the right thing. And it just kind of raises the need for, you know, more enforcement of the laws that do exist to protect people who HUD policies are designed to benefit.
But let's face it, the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, mm-hmm. he got rich off robo-signing a bunch of foreclosed mortgages out here in Pasadena through a bank. So he got rich off the misery of others, and he's the Secretary of Treasury. So not exactly a shining example. So just in the last couple of minutes, though, there was some negative publicity earlier about Ben Carson, perhaps at the urging of his wife, to spend an enormous amount of money on a desk. I think it was $31,000. That sort of blew up. We know about all of the other cabinet members who have problems with their profligate spending of taxpayer mm-hmm. money, like Scott Pruitt at the EPA. What's your sense about whether, in the scale of things, we know that the VA nominee, Ronny Jackson, is in terrible trouble. We don't know about Pruitt. Trump seems to be sticking by him, and Pruitt's actually lobbying to become the next attorney general if they could find a way to fire Jeff Sessions and kill the Mueller investigation. Where would you place Ben Carson in terms of the roiling scandals in this cabinet and this administration? Or has he dodged a bullet in by canceling the purchase of the desk?
Well, I think that, you know, it's just indicative of kind of a general sense of entitlement that a lot of the people who have been appointed to these offices of public trust have at least held up to the current period of time. And what they're starting to learn is that there are procedures and policies in place in the agencies where they're serving that put restrictions on that type of abuse. And fortunately, there are people still present in the core civil service positions throughout the government who are watchdogging some of those activities and acting as whistleblowers when they see abuses, because that's the main way that the public is learning about those things now. And in some cases, it can be understood as kind of just a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding of what the policies are in their agencies. But when public officials, especially in times when budgets are tight and proposals for a variety of different types of austerity measures are being forwarded, still are involved in some of this excessive behavior, it's really the kind of the visibility of that type of abuse that hopefully will temper some of those activities in the future.
Well, Robert Silverman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Silverman, who's a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Buffalo School of Architecture and Planning, who studies community development and inequity in urban communities. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the most brazen admission on the part of Mick Mulvaney, the head of the OMB and acting head of the CFPB, who before a group of bankers yesterday, in effect said, if you pay, you can play.
Ooh, storm is raging, fire is out to blow. someone on the TV, a tepid low, revolving doors, what will I become?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Gilbert, the Vice President of Legislative Affairs at Public Citizen, where she advocates for government transparency and integrity, financial reform, civil justice, and consumer protection. She's testified before Congress and is a contributor to The Hill and writes frequently for The Huffington Post and Yahoo Finance, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Gilbert.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Mick Mulvaney, who is the head of the Office of Management and Budget and the interim director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, spoke yesterday in Washington, D.C. to the American Bankers Association. And he basically told those gathered that if you want to play, you have to pay. He went on specifically to say, "We had a hierarchy in my office in Congress. If you're a lobbyist who never gave us money, I didn't talk to you. If you're a lobbyist who gave us money, I might talk to you." That's pretty brazen, don't you think? I mean, it's honest and unusual,
yes,
that kind of honesty, but it's sort of depressingly brazen, isn't it?
Yes. I think Mick Mulvaney was outing the open secret, the reason that at least at Public Citizen we focused so much on campaign finance reform, because it's obvious that politicians choose to spend their time with those who give them money, but really rarely do people admit that openly, and certainly not in a public setting while addressing a bunch of bankers. So brazen is definitely a good word for it.
But my understanding is that Congress members, and this is both Republicans and Democrats, literally trip over each other to try and get a seat on the banking committee because that's a surefire way to raise money. Is that your understanding in Washington?
Yes. Certainly the banking committee is a sought-after post. And one of the reasons is the most many moneyed corporations, the biggest banks, are the ones that are able to give contributions or care the most to give contributions if you sit on that committee. So, yes, I think it's highly sought after, and that's the reason why.
And the American Bankers Association have contributed more than $32,000 to Mick Mulvaney's political campaign. So hardly a coincidence.
Yes, it's easy to say. That is true.
So what's your sense then of the broader issues? I mean, it's not just that these people are corrupt in this Trump administration. They're also incredibly incompetent, and they're reckless. And look at the lack of vetting. Just go through the list. You've got this White House doctor who has got so many complaints coming against him from his colleagues in uniform. And here he is right at the White House. It's not like they had to look very far to figure out what was going on. And he's handing out pills on Air Force One to everybody and drunk. Apparently during the Obama era, he was so drunk that had Obama tripped over and needed a Band-Aid. The guy was completely incapacitated. It's just unbelievable. So here he is being offered up to head up the second biggest agency in government. You had that guy was nominated for by Trump to head up the Department of Labor, who was a wife beater. You had the woman from the Center for Disease Control making stock deals on tobacco stocks while she's supposed to be taking care of America's health. And I could go through the list. So you're there in Washington. I know you're fighting against these people on a daily basis. But do you get the impression that the rest of the country is waking up to these absolute crooks who promised to drain the swamp but are absolutely wallowing in corruption?
Yes, I think that the list you started to rattle off is just the tip of the iceberg, unfortunately, and it is starting to resonate across the country when they see, you know, the HHS secretary taken out of his post because he used taxpayer dollars to fly around the country on private jets, when they see Scott Pruitt, the deregulator who's hurting our air, water, and public spaces, spend taxpayer dollars for an unnecessary huge security detail, or cozy up with lobbyists to get a cheap deal on housing. You know, these types of stories resonate with people, and eventually, you know, it starts to break through. And I think we're very much at that point. And, you know, while I wish that Mick Mulvaney was an isolated incident, it's clearly far from the case, although he may be one of the most egregious as he attempts to run two agencies and undercut the mission of the one where he's not even lawfully appointed, the CFPB.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Gilbert, who's the Vice President of Legislative Affairs at Public Citizen, where she advocates for governmental transparency and integrity, financial reform, civil justice, and consumer protection. She's testified before Congress and is a contributor to The Hill and writes frequently for The Huffington Post and Yahoo Finance, amongst other publications. So Mulvaney, of course, is wrecking the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as fast as he can. But he's, I mean, the worst thing about these people is it's not, I mean, obviously they've given the Koch brothers everything they want, the Congress, Ryan and McConnell, and, you know, they're free to pollute and profit, and they're behind so much political activity because they spread their money around Washington. Probably they're worth $100 billion, so they've got plenty of loose change, shall we say. But you've got that crowd at the top just siphoning off or directing the entire government towards their largesse and enrichment. And then you've got Mulvaney and company, who seem to be real bottom feeders. He spends all of his time taking care of payday lenders. And Betsy DeVos takes all of her time taking care of these horrible for-profit colleges that have been ripping off all these kids and indenturing them from life with insurmountable debts and with worthless diplomas. So do you see a sort of level of corruption here, that there's the sort of huge wholesale corruption in terms of the big plutocrats like the Koch brothers getting everything they want, but then you've got people like Mulvaney taking care of bottom feeders?
Yes. I mean, I think we're dealing with two discrete problems here. We've seen people chosen for the cabinet posts and other high-level positions in the administration who truly follow the president's lead in wanting to profit off of the administration and feeling entitled to every perk that they can get. And that has led to some of the corrupt activities we've seen. And of course, the inappropriate vetting has disclosed that they were corrupt before they got to the administration. But then the secondary problem that you're highlighting, both with DeVos and Mulvaney, are the fact that they truly have been chosen to run agencies where they disagree with the mission. So when you have someone running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau who thinks that it should not protect consumers but serve industry, you wind up with policies that make no sense and harm the public.
Well, specifically, though, Mulvaney at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they had had a long-standing running case against payday lenders, which he killed. He dropped the case.
Exactly.
But Mulvaney has received $63,000 from payday lenders while he was in Congress. So if you go back to what he told the bankers, if you're a lobbyist who never gave us money, I didn't talk to you. But if you're a lobbyist who gave us money, I might talk to you. Well, he's not just talking to the payday lenders. He's doing their bidding. It's unbelievable. So brazen.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, I think we're seeing corruption and we're also seeing true ideological policy disagreements with what the public wants. So it's a terrible combination. And certainly, you know, it speaks to the need for reforms. I think, you know, one thing that we hope at Public Citizen that we see coming out of this administration, maybe as soon as 2019, you know, after the election, is real reform to address some of these egregious abuses. I think the public is getting sick and tired of what they're seeing, and we will probably have a moment for change.
So rather than wring our hands and get depressed, which I'm getting depressed and I'm sure our listeners are, as I say, it's just extraordinary to think that maybe a third or more of the people in this country do not accept the reality of what Trump is doing. I mean, they seem to be immune to evidence and they're living in the Fox Sinclair bubble where none of this is being reported and where all this fake news and praise. And they've put forth this idea that the deep state is trying to sabotage our great and fearless leader. And the truth of the matter is that this will go down in history, I'm sure, as probably the most corrupt administration in American history. It seems so obvious, at least to me. What's your sense of the mood in Washington? We've seen all the populist promises he made on the stump. Now we're dealing with the reality on a daily basis. It's not, as I say, it's not just corruption, it's also incompetence. They can't even get people appointed. They just can't do anything right. It's a joke. I mean, listening to this guy speak, the president, it's embarrassing. He barely makes sense and just keeps repeating really stupid aphorisms. So is it catching on, do you think? And I asked you earlier about whether the broader public's waking up, but if people have been around Washington for a long time, they must have some kind of historical memory of governments that were competent and less than competent, and they must have be able to grade what's going on now. So what's your sense of whether there's a sense that, my God, you know, not only trying to report on these people is a hard job because you can't believe what happens on a daily basis, but do people really, being in government for a while, recognize that this is just beyond belief what's happening?
Yes, I think they do. I think that there's no question that this is a level above and beyond anything we've seen before, both when it comes to corruption and also when it comes to the sorts of racist, ideological, dangerous policies that they are pushing as an administration. And, you know, there will be a moment of reckoning. I think it's a pendulum, and we've swung incredibly far one direction. And I believe and think that we'll see a referendum, both in elections, but also when it comes to policymakers throwing up their hands. You know, I think we're close to that tipping point, and we will see what puts us over the edge.
Well, but we had an earlier inkling of what Mulvaney just said yesterday, the American bankers, you know, where he just basically talked about how corrupt it all is, and, you know, it's an acceptable fact, and he doesn't have a problem with it, and presumably the people who give money, like the bankers, don't have a problem. That's how Washington works. But we had an inkling of the same kind of cynicism at around the time of the so-called tax reform bill, where one of the Congress people, Representative Chris Collins of New York, basically said, my donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again. In other words, pass these tax cuts for the rich and the corporations, et cetera. And mostly, and we now know in retrospect, that this hasn't helped the middle class. It was sold as a middle class tax cut. It hasn't helped the middle class one iota, but it's been absolutely a massive gift to Wall Street. And at the time also, I recall Senator Lindsey Graham said the same thing, that if we don't get this bill passed, because it's basically the only bill that Trump's been able to pass. So they felt they had a lot at stake. But the long and the short of it is, the impetus to get it passed was, if we don't pass it, our donors will desert us. So the writing was on the wall back then, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think this is definitely not the first time we're hearing of this. And you pointed out the tax bill. I think there's numerous other instances where we've understood very clearly what the Trump administration stands for, including the fact that they're trying to claw back money that they just put in the spending bill for important programs and policies, and now they're trying to rescind it. You know, they constantly do the thing that feels worst for the American public. It's just a question of when that breaks through, and, you know, it does seem like we are at a tipping point, both because of these horrible policies, but also because of the actions of those at the highest level of government, which people are now seeing and understanding.
But isn't Mulvaney really giving these bankers a huge gift? Because isn't he going to give the bankers access to the public database used by consumers to file complaints against financial institutions?
Yes. So as I was saying earlier, in addition to being corrupt, he also has bad policy ideas. And one piece of that is making the database, which is directly intended to help consumers better understand how industry is ripping them off and make complaints and see where there are trends. He's talking about making that private and only giving certain entities access. So it's a very clear, obvious contraband of what the agency's mission is.
Well, but so the big settlement, the big fine of $1 billion against Wells Fargo, that was cosmetic, was it not? I mean, it made him look good, like he was actually doing the job of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But my understanding is that Wells Fargo can write that $1 billion fine off on their taxes.
Yes, they can write it off on their taxes, and it's not enough. That said, I think you know, most of that credit doesn't go to Mulvaney, but goes to the people who work at the CFPB who were working on the settlement long before him. So, you know, I don't want to undercut how important it is that Wells Fargo be fined, as that is, you know, a critical part of the mission of the CFPB.
So do you think Trump is the one that's setting the example here, that him and his family are doing business? It's not like all the predecessors who put their stuff into trusts and this, you know.
Yes, yes. Like I said earlier, I think that Trump, you know, his mantra is profit off the presidency, and he certainly has chosen people who feel the same.
So just to wrap up here, though, because I keep sort of going back to how upsetting this is and how frustrating it is that you just somehow can't break through. I mean, maybe there is a critical mass developing of American citizens realizing the obvious, because you can't deny it, even though we do have Soviet-type propaganda mechanisms in this country like Fox News that create an alternative reality. I don't know how long that can last and how long that constituency can remain so deluded. But do you think at the end of the day, well, not even at the end of the day, is it really just down to the midterm elections, the only mechanism that we have to change this appalling situation?
Well, I wouldn't say only. I mean, I think elections are an incredibly important moment to express how we feel as citizens. So it's a good thing that we have one coming up where we can do that so loudly and robustly and change the conversation by putting new people into office. But before then, I think we have absolute power to engage with our members, and we should. On every one of these issues that upsets us, we should make calls, we should tell them what we think, and we should use that to change the conversation. So, you know, we're not powerless. We are all citizens in this democracy, and it's important that we weigh in with those that we elected.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Lisa, and I need to stay in touch with you, even though I just get so frustrated and so angry with, I mean, I guess this guy's done us all a favor by at least Mulvaney showing who he really is, and he's unashamed of his own corruption, which
exactly. The writing is on the wall. Now we just need to yell about it.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Gilbert, who's the Vice President of Legislative Affairs at Public Citizen, where she advocates for government transparency and integrity, financial reform, civil justice, and consumer protection. She's testified before Congress and is a contributor to The Hill and writes frequently for The Huffington Post and Yahoo Finance, among other publications. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet